from the fair weather shelter of our North Carolina Reading Service. We read the Indie Week for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners. I am John Federson with the current issue, and it's dated December the 22nd of 2023. And it goes something like this. First on our bulletin board today from Durham, help wanted, Durham City Council Ward 3. If the answer to all of these questions is an enthusiastic yes, you may be the perfect candidate for Durham City Council's Ward 3 seat. Mayor Leonardo Williams vacated that seat when he ascended to the top job last month. Per the city's charter, the council must make a good faith effort to fill that seat within 60 days of the vacancy. If the six sitting council members can't reach a consensus, the seat will be up for a special election in 2024. On Tuesday, the city clerk said the city had only received three applications for the seat. In a city that's sick of the council drama of the past 2 years, the appointee will have the chance to help the mayor move on and address substantial challenges of affordable housing, workers' wages, and public safety. Any city council is an undeniably tough place to work. This city deserves someone with the community connections, interpersonal skills, and true desire to put their head down and do that work to make Durham a better place for everyone. Salary. Part-time position, but probably should be full-time. Right now, the salary is $35,200 annually. Applicants must be at least 21 years of age, live within the corporate city limits of Durham, reside in Ward 3 of the City of Durham, be a registered voter within the Durham County Board of Elections, and be current on city and county taxes at the time of submission of the application. Next steps. Whoa. Applicants must fill out this initial application by 5 p.m. Thursday, December 21st. Well, I'm reading this on Thursday, December 21st, so if you won't have heard this article, it'll be too late. Here's hoping you've already done it. The first broadcast of this particular show is Friday, the 22nd. I'm not going to go into it except to read some testimonials from past and current council members. They're amusing enough as it is. Former council member Monique Holsey-Hyman, I hope nobody else ever goes through what I went through. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton, are you going to hit me again? Former Mayor Elaine O'Neill, I appreciate it. Being from a hometown that would take a little girl from the west end of Durham and raise her up to be mayor. We are always Bull City strong. Former Councilmember Charlie Reese, you couldn't pay me enough to run for office right now. Former Mayor Steve Shule, it's been hard, but I'm proud of us. And Elaine O'Neill finally said, I've enjoyed working with you all somewhat. All right. So that article needn't actually have been read because of the deadline for application is Thursday the 21st. On. Well, on Monday, the Durham City Council voted 4-2 to not extend the city's contract with the ShotSpotter Gunshot Detection Service for an additional 3 months after its year-long pilot program ended on December 14. Activists gathered at City Hall Monday to object to the continued use of ShotSpotter, saying the tool was an inefficient use of taxpayer dollars and it further discriminated against black and brown communities. Many speakers also leveraged their time during the public hearing to draw attention to the conflict in Gaza by demanding the City Council sign a ceasefire resolution brought forth by UE Local 150, a union that represents public workers throughout North Carolina. Leslie Sandre, one of 15 speakers during this public hearing, said, "We need you all to stand with us against Israel's bombardment of Gaza by passing the permanent ceasefire resolution that we sent to you." According to City Council procedure, folks who sign up to speak on an agenda item are expected to remain on topic. Items not included on the general business agenda are discussed during Citizens Matters at the City Council work session. Mayor Williams asked multiple times for speakers to stay on the topic of ShotSpotter, but was repeatedly met with resistance throughout the public hearing as speakers reiterated their calls for ceasefire resolution. Manju Rajendran, a local activist and member of Durham Beyond Policing, said it's hard to ignore the correlation between injustice in Durham and conflict abroad. Quote, "ShotSpotter gunshot surveillance has been sold to black and brown community members as a false solution to the gun violence and heartbreak that's hurting our communities. I understand we are not to connect the dots between the ways that social spending has been gutted to pay for war, militarism, and ShotSpotter, but I think there are dots to connect here around policing, incarceration, and the fact that workers have been coming year after year and begging to be paid wages that would allow them to live in this city." The City Council approved the $200,000 contract with ShotSpotter, whose parent company is now called Sound Thinking Incorporated, in last year's budget by a vote of 4-3. The technology covered a 3-mile area covering parts of East Durham and Southeast. Members of Council were divided on whether ShotSpotter would be a welcome tool for better public safety or a weapon that police would wield against marginalized communities who are already over-surveilled and over-policed. Mayor Williams, Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton, and Councillor Didriana Freeman were among the proponents, along with then-Mayor Elaine O'Neill. Former council member Jillian Johnson said at the time that she wondered if the company was choosing which successful stories to highlight in its promotion of the technology's efficacy. Now that the pilot program is over, city staff has enlisted the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke University to administer a third-party examination of the data and report its findings back to City Council. That work is expected to happen over the next 3 months, during which time the ShotSpotter service will not be in effect. The council could choose to renew its contract with ShotSpotter after the analysis. Middleton, one of the two votes to continue ShotSpotter on Monday, along with Williams, said it's important to see the data before making a decision on whether to move away from the program. According to the ShotSpotter dashboard on the city's website, he noted, over 70% of recorded incidents did not have a corresponding 9/11 phone call. Quote, "Tonight, there are people in their homes watching this meetings who have family members sitting next to them who survived a gunshot wound because we got to them while they were bleeding out and no one called 9/11. Middleton said, "There are thousands of people who live in our city who have resigned themselves to the proposition that nightly gunfire is just the way it is." Community members raised concerns about spending money on ShotSpotter in lieu of other programs that could improve mental, physical well-being and reduce crime. Although Williams voted to extend ShotSpotter on Monday, he has been a proponent of increasing investment in youth services, which he reiterated during the meeting. Quote, "I hear a lot of the commentary around why not ShotSpotter. I actually agree with a lot of it. I said the same thing. We do need more food security programs. We do need better health care. We do need after-school programs. Our kids are too bored in this city. We have to have more of a robust recreational program across the entire city. We have to invest in our kids." A different article does talk more about the ceasefire proposal for Gaza. More than 200 people calling for this in the conflict between Israel and Hamas gathered in Durham Central Park Saturday to sing, march, and fly kites in honor of Palestinian youth who in 2011 broke a world record for the most number of kites flown simultaneously. The demonstration was organized by local collective Mothers for Ceasefire, and co-sponsored by 27 other groups, including that labor union UE150 and the Triangle Chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP. The demonstration came as the child death toll in the besieged Gaza Strip neared another horrific milestone. Three times as many children have now been killed in Gaza since the start of the war in October as were killed in all conflicts globally in 2022. Many attendees of Saturday's event were young children and preteens. Some brought kites and others made their own at the on-site craft station, taping string and streamers to paper plates. Because the weather wasn't particularly windy, children ran laps around the park to get lift, coaxing them to ride on the air currents in their wake. Down the hill, closer to the winter farmers market underway on the other side of the park, a group of carolers sang Christmas songs with lyrics altered to match the cause. Stop the bombs, the news is dire, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. We demand a full ceasefire, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. DeWitt added this. Let's see, who is DeWitt? Did I read it? Yes, Ellie DeWitt. There is tension at this event between grief and joy. This is Ellie DeWitt, a student rabbi and member of Mothers for Ceasefire and JVP Triangle. That's the Jewish Voice for Peace. She and other organizers dispersed pamphlets to parents with tips for navigating conversations about the conflict, saying, "We want to channel our love for our own children into love and support and awareness for the kids in Gaza. We want to give our kids a space to process what they've been hearing and take inspiration from it." An hour into this demonstration, attendees grew spirited as a giant helium balloon banner reading, "Gaza will be free," was led up into the sky. In keeping with the child-centered spirit of the event, the crowd chanted, "Let Gaza play," and banged drums as the banner rose to the end of a 100-foot tether. After that, speakers, all of whom were children, stepped up to the mic. Zidane, a 7-year-old boy who was born in Palestine. "My second cousin is almost exactly my age. His name is Ilklas, and he is starving to death." 9-year-old Maria, another native Palestinian. "My family is in Gaza. I am worried all the time." T, a 9-year-old with a Palestinian mom and Jewish dad, recited, "If I Must Die," a poem written by the professor and writer Rifat Alrir shortly before he was killed by an Israeli airstrike on December 7th. T said of Alrir in a preface to the poem, he knew he was probably going to die. T's mom is Nadine Bir, a co-founder of Mothers for Ceasefire. Bir told Indy that her father, T's grandfather, was 8 years old when Israeli soldiers forced him to leave Jaffa during the 1948 mass displacement event known as the Nakba. "All of my family," Bir said, "is very present with me as we watch the destruction of Gaza and the genocide of the Palestinian people." Beyond its namesake cause, Mothers for Ceasefire is also demanding humanitarian aid to Gaza and an end to U.S. military aid that supports Israel's war on Gaza and violent occupation in the West Bank, according to a news release, urging local congressional representatives to call for a ceasefire wasn't as big a part of Saturday's demonstration as it has been at other actions over the last 2 months. That's in part because pressure from Mothers for Ceasefire and JVP Triangle has had an effect, say the groups. Representative Valerie Fouché, whose constituents live in Durham and Orange County, signed a letter with a handful of other congressional members on December 1st that called for a bilateral ceasefire. And Fouché has also agreed to meet with spokespeople from some local advocacy groups, according to DeWitt. DeWitt said they want to make sure Fouché is held accountable to her signature, particularly because one Congress member, Representative Joyce Beattie of Ohio, quietly rescinded her name from the same letter that Fouché had signed. And because of the 62 congressional members who have signed ceasefire letters and resolutions, Fouché is one of just five who have yet to post publicly about a ceasefire on her website or social media platforms. Mothers for Ceasefire also calls on Fouché to sign onto H.R. 786, that's the resolution Representative Cori Bush introduced in late October. The group asks the same of Representatives Wiley Nickel and Deborah Ross, who represent parts of Wake County, and have not yet expressed any support for a ceasefire to date. Also from Durham, workers at Durham Starbucks land a union victory. These workers voted overwhelmingly in favor of forming a union yesterday, this is about a week ago, making their store the first unionized Starbucks in the Triangle and the third in the state. The 16-2 victory at the store comes during an eventful 2 years for the corporate behemoth after a group of Buffalo Starbucks filed union election petitions in August of 2021, and a swath of stores across the country followed suit. Since then, union momentum has faced setbacks during a fierce anti-union campaign by the corporation. Of the 7 Starbucks stores in North Carolina that have held elections in the past few years, 4 have failed. But Workers United, the parent union of Starbucks Workers United, now has more than 9,000 members. The corporation itself has also faced challenges. In November, it saw an $11 billion loss as shares took a dramatic 9% dive amid boycotts of Starbucks' stance on the conflict in Gaza. On Friday, the coffee chain announced that it wanted to restart bargaining talks after a 6-month impasse. In Durham, workers at the store on Renaissance Parkway say they began quiet organizing talks during the summer. Shift supervisor Russell Cazaretta helped to kick off the effort after a particularly taxing shift in August. Several workers had called out of the shift, Cazaretta says, because Starbucks keeps all of its ordering channels open, regardless of staffing. The employees on duty had been stretched thin while juggling in-person customers, mobile orders, and orders from third-party delivery services. Calzaretta says, it was one of those moments where I wanted to take off my apron and just leave for good. But then I thought about all the other people I work with. I was like, if I leave now, then I'm doing what Starbucks wants me to do. You know, don't make any noise, just leave peacefully when you're dissatisfied. After clocking out of that shift, he sat in his car and began researching Starbucks Workers United, that's SWU, the bargaining unit that represents the 300-plus unionized locations in the United States. He made contact with a union representative who offered guidance and educational materials. Then he formed an organizing committee with 2 co-workers. Calzaretta says, the early process was very hush-hush. We knew if word got out before we were ready, we would be bombarded by district managers and regional managers trying to talk people out of it before we could even educate ourselves. The organizing committee gauged a high level of union interest among staff. Everyone seemed frustrated about the same issues: wages, staffing, inconsistent scheduling. Calzaretta, citing medical, vision, and dental plans, as well as a program that covers tuition costs for workers to get an online degree from Arizona State University, says, you have to work a certain amount of hours to be eligible for benefits. Since scheduling is so inconsistent, there are employees who pick up shifts at 3 or 4 other Starbucks stores every week to meet the quota for hours and keep health care and education. In October, the committee filed for a union election with the National Labor Relations Board. The cat was out of the bag. Calzaretta says managers started to hear about it and have conversations with us. The conversations started out really peaceful. They would say, All we care about is that you educate themselves and vote in the way you think will work best for you. Things shifted when workers put out a letter of intent to unionize, signed by nearly every employee in the store. Managers began pulling workers to the side mid-shift and explicitly telling them to vote against the union, says Calzaretta. It was discouraging. It was scary. But we all kind of metaphorically huddled together in the corner, turned our back to everything, and just took the brunt force of it. In a statement to Indy, a spokesman for Starbucks wrote the company, quote, fully honored the process laid out by the NLRB and encouraged our partners to exercise their right to vote in the election to have their voice heard. We respect our partners' right to organize, freely associate, engage in lawful union activities, and bargain collectively without fear of reprisal or retaliation. While we continue to believe we can do more to elevate the partner experience by working shoulder to shoulder than across a negotiating table, we respect our partners' decision at our Renaissance Center Durham location to elect union representation. Once the NLRB certifies the outcome of the election, a representative from the store can initiate the bargaining process, the spokesperson wrote. Calzaretta, who had no organizing experience before this effort, attributes the success at Durham store to assistance from SWU union representatives, community support, and the courage and collective resilience of his co-workers. Quote, Starbucks calls its workers partners instead of employees, to suggest that employees are not just a number to them, that we're helping to build this great company that has all these great values. So, we're asking Starbucks to actually see that through. We're asking them to come to the table and meet us, the partners, in good faith. All right, we're moving more or less to Chapel Hill, and the interim chancellorship at UNC Chapel Hill has been filled by Lee Roberts. Friday morning was named a widely anticipated move that sets up leadership at this flagship state university until a national search for a permanent leader is conducted. Roberts is the co-founder of North Carolina-based Sharp View Capital and a current member of the UNC System Board of Governors. He most prominently served as state budget director under Republican Governor Pat McCrory from 2014 to 16. An alum of Duke and Georgetown universities, he's also taught at Duke's Public Policy School. Roberts' appointment has been rumored since news broke last month that Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz was considering a job as Michigan State University's next president. Roberts starts as interim on January 12th, and a national search will begin for a permanent chancellor after that. The next chancellor enters a heated environment full of political tension, uncertainty over the school's vision, and a profound lack of trust throughout the Carolina community. Ahead of Friday's announcement, Roberts sat down separately with three media outlets, including the Assembly, and it's from this article in the Assembly that Indy Week has created this article. A brief interview about he'll approach the challenge. Roberts was friendly but guarded. He's largely described as a smart, ambitious, wonky, and technocratically inclined. While there's little doubt he's qualified to run a complicated operation, there are many questions about how he will navigate the various pressures on his new role. The most frequent criticism from insiders is about his leadership experience. His past roles have largely been behind the scenes, focused on operations and management. UNC's Chapel Hill's chancellor is among the most public and prominent positions in the state. The role has to manage relationships with legislators, donors, students, faculty, staff, and media. Roberts will need to juggle and manage a set of stakeholders who all want different things. There's also skepticism about his lack of UNC ties, particularly before joining the system's Board of Governors in 2021. Two of the last three chancellors spent decades at the institution before taking the top job. Some see Robert's outsider status as an asset, but others see it as a weakness. He'll also face some skepticism from a liberal-leaning campus for his connection to Republicans and his professional experience in the investment world. But he has other notable connections in and beyond politics. His wife, Lisa, was the founding editor of the well-known Raleigh magazine, Walter, and recently wrote a book on North Carolina art. His mother, the late journalist Cokie Roberts, won Edward R. Murrow and Emmy Awards for her work at NPR, where she was considered a founding mother. His grandfather was a Democratic U.S. House Majority Leader, representing Louisiana, while his grandmother chaired the Democratic National Convention and spent two decades in Congress. In the coming weeks, we'll have much more reporting on the future at UNC Chapel Hill. For now, here's how Roberts described his plans as interim in his own words. On criticism that he's better suited to be a COO, not CEO. If you think about what the best chancellors do, the skills they bring to bear are skills that I've brought to bear my entire career. They're leading these complex organizations. They're doing it with decisiveness and empathy and humility. They're world-class listeners. They're building great teams. They're making sure the students and the faculty and staff have the resources they need to do their jobs. They're not telling the experts how to do their jobs. They're making sure the place is as welcoming as possible and everyone feels like they belong there. And they're representing the organization to the broader world in a complex and challenging political and media environment. I think everything I've done since I graduated from law school 30 years ago has helped train me for that. On who his boss is within a complicated governance system. I don't think there's any ambiguity about the governance. The chancellor reports to the system president, Peter Hans. On how he'll work with the board. The Board of Trustees is a group of really committed, really impressive Carolina alums who care a lot about the future of the institution and have got a lot of really good ideas, so who wouldn't want that input? On his top priority for the school. People talk about Carolina as one of the top five public universities in the country, and it's clearly that by any objective metric that you want to look at. But I think the future belongs to North Carolina as a state. We are this incredibly dynamic, interesting, fast-growing place where people want to move from around the country and around the world. And there's no more important piece of that than Carolina. There's no reason why Carolina shouldn't aspire to be head and shoulders the best public university in America. Set that as a goal and be thought of not as just one of the best, but as clearly the best. It's not easy to do, and it's not going to happen overnight, but I think when you're talking about vision, that should be our objective. On why he's taking this job. I care a lot about the state. I care a lot about higher education. I care a lot about public service. I've raised a family here. I built a business here. As I say, I think the future belongs to North Carolina. I'm going to be speaking at Winston-Salem State's December graduation. One of the fun parts about being on the Board of Governors is you get to go around and offer greetings from the Board of Governors. Congratulations to the graduates. I've done it at Winston-Salem State before. One thing I always say to the students, I hope you'll spend your careers in North Carolina. I'd raise your families here, and I know a lot of you will. But for those who are on the fence, I believe the future belongs to North Carolina. And if I were graduating from college anywhere else, I'd be trying to figure out how to get here as quickly as possible. And I believe that. We don't have a more important institution than Carolina when it comes to the future of the state and health of the state. On his interest in higher education and public service. I've served on the Board of Governors, When I served in the budget office, we had the first general obligation bond issue in 15 years. The $2 billion Connect NC bond issue, and half of that went to higher education. I've served on the Community College Board. I served on the Board of Visitors to the Sanford School at Duke. I've had a consistent theme of being involved in and caring about higher education. I grew up caring a lot about public service. It sometimes sounds a little naive or corny when you talk about it. But my grandparents were members of Congress. My parents were journalists. They talked about the importance of giving back to the institutions that our country depends on. And I know some people will roll their eyes at it, but it's meaningful to me. On the early criticisms of him and his lack of UNC ties. What I've heard mostly so far is concern over where I went to college. I understand the instinctive reaction, but I think any concern that I can't adequately do this job because of that is, frankly, a little bit silly. I'm grateful to Duke for first bringing me here when I was 17. I got a great liberal arts education there, but I'm confident that I can do this job with the best interests of Carolina, and only the best interests of Carolina at heart. On the changes happening in athletics nationally. So athletics, obviously, is crucial to the mission. It's important for fundraising. It's important for affinity. It teaches all kinds of important leadership lessons and teamwork and integration. I also think that at a time when nationally we're starved for things that bring us together, that we can all get behind college sports are one of the few things that serve that role. And so, to me, that alone would be reason to support and encourage college sports. But it's obviously in a period of significant change. I'm not sure there's been another period when college sports are so unstable. And so the role of whoever's leading Carolina and the rest of the leadership team at Carolina is to make sure that when the dust settles, Carolina is better off. On the push to explore moving Carolina from the ACC to the SEC or another conference, it's an important financial question. It's an important cultural question. I think it's going to take a lot of time from everyone involved going forward. On the effort he helped lead to change the UNC system's funding model. The previous funding model was broken. All it really did was incentivize the growth of student credit hours, which didn't really align with the board's strategic vision for the system or the campus's own strategic visions. It was especially harmful to smaller campuses in an era of declining enrollment, or at least not rapidly growing enrollment. And so what the funding model does is just realign incentives, and it gives the campuses a way to grow their resources without having growth in student credit hours as the only tool. And it aligns incentives with the strategic direction of the system and the state. On the funding model's performance-based elements and how it applies to Carolina, my candid answer is the funding model probably does not apply as well to Carolina as it does to some other schools in the system because one size doesn't fit all. We knew that when we first designed it. Right now, everyone does have the same performance metrics. Their targets are different, but the metrics they're judged on and the performance weighting calculations are all the same. Carolina just is different in lots of important ways from other schools in the system, and there's been a conversation underway about looking at that. Over tension over whether Carolina is too far to the left or right as an institution. It's crucial that Carolina represents the whole state. It doesn't just represent a part of the state. It doesn't belong to any particular group. It belongs to everybody in North Carolina. On how he'll approach the first few months of the role. First is the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. The second is to ensure a smooth transition. Third, make sure the students and faculty and staff have what they need to listen to them. And the fourth is, I think anybody would come in with this hope, for as long as the interim period lasts, to leave it at least a little better than how you found it. On whether he'll apply for permanent role, I haven't crossed that bridge yet. I haven't even started the interim role yet. Minutes left in today's Indie Week, and I have a few artistic, mostly musical, articles to read. But now I have time to read one. All of those, by the way, I've had to put off in the last few issues, and now is my chance to catch up. The first one about Morgan Stickney, a Paralympic swimmer's two-part race against time. Morgan Stickney has never hit snooze in her life. When her alarm goes off in the morning, she has 27 minutes to get from her pillow to the pool for practice in Cary, North Carolina. Once at the Olympic grade pool, she has less than 45 seconds to swim 50 meters to the end. She trains for 2 hours every day with two races in mind. The first is training for the 2024 Paris Paralympics, where she will compete in 10 months. The second is a race against her body. There's no telling when it will betray her again. At 15, what started as the breakage of a small bone in her left foot at swim practice worsened into years of agony and confusion. Surgeries proved as ineffective as the doctor's visits were inconclusive. Only potent drugs helped manage the pain. At 18 years old, she faced a decision: amputation, or what was becoming an opioid addiction. Her surgeon removed her left leg below the knee. She rebounded, reworking her stroke as a para swimmer. She qualified to race at the 2021 Tokyo Paralympics, but her right leg suffered soon after, leading to a diagnosis: the cause of her original amputation, of a cardiovascular disease that limits the flow of blood to her legs. Only one other person in the United States suffers from the same condition. There's not even a name for it yet. Less than 2 years after the first amputation, Stickney became a double amputee. Still, she found her way back between pool lanes, determined to complete in Tokyo. She took home 2 golds. After the victory, Stickney thought the only race ahead of her was her next Paralympics. But a new understanding of the progressive nature of her condition means it now threatens one of her knees and one of her arms. Doctors believe it will eventually come for her organs. Now 26, Stickney will need a life-saving bone marrow transplant, but she decided it can wait until after Paris. Right now, her doctor is using a Band-Aid treatment, holding off pain and progression long enough for her to compete in August. Until then, she rotates 4 to 6 weeks of training in the pool, with 9 days of pain treatment at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She takes the same flights each time, practicing before flying out and waking up for dawn practice after she returns home to Cary around midnight. She said, "I have everything down to a T, yeah, and that's just kind of how I live." The mornings at Triangle Aquatic Center are cold and quiet. Steam rises from the pool as the swimmers like Stickney stir the water. A steady pulse of water slaps the pool edges, on beat with the emerald-lit pace clock. Once Stickney finishes a set, she pops up a big dimpled grin beneath the reflective goggles, which replace her glasses while she's in the water. Even without seeing her prosthetics, it's clear that her arms are her job. Her hair is usually somewhere between pool-soaked and dry. She doesn't seem to mind all the stopwatches timing her life, saying, "The pool's kind of like my sanctuary. It's kind of how me and my sports psych talk about it. When I'm in the pool, I don't think about anything I'm going through." Stickney took home two golds from that 2021 Tokyo. Her early and able-bodied swim career was defined by a watertight devotion to the sport, said Brian Crawford, her club swim coach throughout high school and middle school. Crawford witnessed Stickney's ascent to elite swimming beginning as a teenager, training at Executive Swim Club in Manchester, New Hampshire. She ranked in the top 20 in the country as distance swimmer by the age of 14. Crawford said she was unusually coachable. When Crawford made a big deal about not missing practice, Stickney did not miss a single one for 2 years. She was the first one there and raced every single set. Sometimes Crawford had his swimmers write essays. Stickney detailed how to swim at Stanford, where she had aspired to compete when she was younger. Her thesis? Hard work, dedication, and extra work. You need to do extra work outside the pool. One way you can do this is by having goals and thinking about them as if they are already true, says her final paragraph. But the goals she had in mind at 14 and the extra work on her plate looks simpler than what Stickney faces now as she continues to push her body and mind through the pool and pain. Coaching her through her strict schedule of training and treatment is John Payne, P-A-Y-N-E. He asks, how is she special? Well, there's an obvious one, Stickney said, smiling and waving around her blue cheetah prosthetics. She decided to stick with her height of 5'6" when choosing her new legs. Laughing, Payne said, when I see Morgan, I see somebody that's going through something really, really difficult. She understands the end point of that, but she does it with a lot more composure than I think many people could. Stickney digs deep with her sports psychologist. One of the main things she works on is overcoming the mental challenge of feeling ill while she's racing. She says, if I don't feel good racing, normally in my mind I would just be, oh, like game over kind of thing. And my coach always said, you don't have to feel good to race fast. So that's something I repeatedly tell myself. Payne adds, we can be honest with each other about what's going on in the water and outside of the water, and that makes the job of getting better that much easier. The volume and intensity they're training with right now seems to be working. Stickney's treatment consists of 9 days of epoprostenol infusions, a drug that dilates blood vessels, typically used to treat hypertension. It has all the side effects of chemotherapy, making her nauseous most days. During her most recent treatment, she lost 20 pounds in less than 2 weeks. Stickney says she doesn't remember much of what goes on in the hospital, as she usually tries to block things out. She points to her parents as her unfaltering army of support. Her mom is always feeding her ice cream, topped with protein powder to help her maintain her weight. But it's challenging to find other Paralympic athletes dealing with what she's facing. Quote, I mean, there's definitely people on my team that have progressive diseases, but they don't normally go in for treatment constantly. Probably 90% of the people in Paralympics were either born that way or became disabled at a very, fairly young age. So even go through what I went through with my amputations was extremely rare. This method is only a short-term solution, Stickney said, as her medical team continues to research cures to prevent loss of her right knee, arm, and eventually organs. The plan is a bone marrow transplant, but Stickney spends hours per week researching too. Her years between hospitals led her to pursue pre-med during undergrad at Biola University before her health worsened and she switched to a psychology degree. She has developed close relationships with her doctors and nurses. Three of them are among the people flying out to watch her race in Paris. Quote, that'll just be so special to have them in the stands. I've been through so much, and they've been there for me throughout it all. People always ask me, oh, how long are you going to swim? And it's always till my body will allow me, because I just truly love the sport. She is also connected with others who have lost limbs in different walks of life. She says, I think sometimes you just have to realize who you are. You know, I've inspired so many people around me, and I really just, it took me a long time to realize that a lot of people look up to me. I have to stand in that and know that I inspire other people and kind of dig into that on the hard days. All right, an earlier article, which was released by IndieWeek on the 15th of November, more than a month ago. Alex Bingham is not afraid of crying at the party, writes Nick McGregor. He's endured a lot those last few years, but as the Hillsboro-based musician is quick to point out, haven't we all? In 2022, Bingham lost three people close to him, a beloved aunt, a college roommate, and a childhood friend. Two succumbed to cancer, Angie quickly and John more slowly, while wedged in between those two deaths, Will died by suicide. Grief engulfed Bingham, but it also birthed something. Good Grief, his debut solo album as Magic Al, released November 10th on Sleepy Cat Records. The album's nine songs intercut joy and sadness, mixing melancholic regret with misty-eyed love. Danceable bangers are backed by skittering synthesizers, hazy acoustic guitars, crisp MPC samples, and Bingham's trademark bass grooves. They also represent Bingham's diverse musical friendships. To make Good Grief, he invited Amelia Meath, Libby Rodenbaugh, Joseph Terrell, Molly Sarley, Chris Frisina, Vivian Leva, Riley Calcagno, Rosali, and Taylor Meyer to co-write the album, turning it into what Bingham calls a producer's record. And since death is universal, the artists that play with Bingham on Good Grief also brought their own experiences of loss to recording sessions for the album at his lakefront Bedtown Studios in rural Virginia. He tells me over lunch in Hillsboro, death used to be my biggest fear. I couldn't talk about it. And losing three people close to me in 1 year broke that all up and redefined how I feel about death. Now he says, it's okay to write about it. There's no longer a fear. Bingham has never been afraid to work hard. He's busy touring with His Golden Messenger, producing and engineering for a growing circle of Triangle friends, and maintaining his circa 1800 Hillsboro homestead and home studio with his wife Carly and two boisterous dogs. As he said last year, when he launched Magic Al, the new artist name and production project is a place to finally call my own, keeping the joy afloat while holding space for the harder things. The ethos is evident on the album opener, Crying at the Party, in which hand claps and disco beats meld with heartfelt lyrics. We all feel you around. Your distant company drifts with me. Released as Good Grief's final single, accompanied by a photo montage of John, the best friend, Bingham calls it the most direct song on the record. It was also the last to make the cut. Bingham didn't intend to sing lead on the song. Initially, he laid down a scratch vocal and circulated it among collaborators. His good friend, Chris Frisina, who performs as Lou Hazel, stepped in. Bingham adopts Frisina's New York accent to tell the story. Chris called me and said, no frickin' way, your scratch vocal is it. Then Chris called everybody else and said, nobody but Al is singing on this. I think of producing as fishing. And Chris is my biggest, dumbest fish. When his eyebrow goes up, I know he'll bite. He's the creative lubricant that gets the energy going. Krishna wrote and sang lead on Party for One, drawing on memories of a lackluster high school prom. the duo party songs pull listeners in opposite direction, mixing elation with sadness, a juxtaposition that also extends to Hello, in which Bingham nails a blend of Petty-esque guitar riffs, Dilla-style beats, and folksy vocals from frequent collaborators Vivian Leva and Taylor Meyer. He says, I've always felt the spiritual connection between old-time music and beat-making. There's deep emotional value in both of them. He juxtaposed Leva's ethereal voice with a jaunty beat that always feels like it's falling backward. The result? Magical, says Bingham. On Party for One and Hello, we found that duality I often search for. Both songs, he adds, were fostered by what became perhaps the album's most critical component, an inflatable Coleman hot tub at the Bedtown Studios Lake House. It turned out to be the most important piece of gear, he laughs. It's a social gathering space, a place to get inspired, and a place to celebrate when the songs were done. So many of them clicked right after getting out of this little plastic hot tub. It's where he and Molly Sarley watched a moon rise over the lake before writing the tenderly haunting There Was a Moon. The duo talked for hours before transforming an initial idea for a big danceable song with a slapping beat into a gentle lament. Molly's not afraid of tackling heavy subjects, Bingham says. She really met me where I was, emotionally, and her voice led us to this heavier, more subdued place. True to Good Grief's caterwauling form, the next two songs, after There Was a Moon, carom in sonically wild directions. 2003 Suburban, 2021 Wedding connects the dots between carefree teenage memories of John with This Must Be the Place, the Talking Heads song that served as John and wife Emily's first dance when they married 2 years ago. Libby Ruddenbaugh was the only collaborator to bring a previously written song, 6 a.m., to the Good Grief sessions. But over pizza, and yes, the hot tub, the duo molded it into something new. There's so much tension in Libby's song, he says. She wrote it about struggling through a morning with your partner, but after we finished it, it feels more like a song about lying awake and grappling with grief. Libby lost her mom while we were recording her album, Between the Blades, at Bedtown. She's my best friend, and she trusted me with a song she'd written, like, Yes, this is a Magic Al thing now. I feel so honored by that trust. Good Grief floats into the ether on the final track, Live Forever, just 99 seconds of haunting vocals from Hillsborough musician Rosali over a gentle guitar strum. Bingham says it was a surefire closer. When Rosali says, Do you want to live forever? I know what my answer is now. No. John was ready to go. My aunt was ready to go. But when Will died, I didn't have the tools to deal with that. In that sense, Good Grief represents a purposeful exercise in devoting time to remembrance, roughly one day per song spent immersed in creation with friends. Bingham says it's really important to make that time. That was one of my first big lessons from grief counseling. I think about it every day. The morning of my interview with Bingham, I was preparing my notes when I found out my oldest friend had unexpectedly died the night before. I briefly considered counseling, but here I was, crafting questions about the grief Bingham faced and the way music offered him a path through it. Perhaps our conversation would be illuminating, even cathartic. Naturally, Bingham was empathetic. He listened as how I described how There Was a Moon had made me cry on the drive to Hillsborough, and how 2003 Suburban flooded me with memories of my own friend. I finished our interview still mired in grief, but also buoyed by the joy Bingham brought to Good Grief. A week later, he followed up by mailing me a copy of Iris Gottlieb's book, Everything is Temporary. Illustrated contemplations on how death shapes our lives. For our second interview, Bingham welcomed me into his organized home studio. Synthesizers, MPCs, pedals, meticulously looped cords lined one wall. Speakers and mixing consoles stood guard around his computer workstation, while handwritten notes, Polaroid grids, and potted plants dotted the in-between spaces. He says, following my interests has always served me best. He reminisced on the limitations he experienced studying classical music in high school and jazz at UNC Greensboro. Every rub I've come up against has led me to this point, to this studio we're in, to this life. He smiles, bright-eyed, below his shaggy red hair. He previews a few new beats, fluidly bouncing between keyboard and sampler, even as he corrals his dogs and shows off some funky bric-a-brac like a Bootsy Collins action figure and the pale yellow Life is Good mug he drinks out of to channel Aunt Angie's spirit. He finishes, I try to produce by recreating these kinds of feelings. If I can make emotions happen through sound, that's my job. And once again, this is a Sleepy Cat Records release from November 10th, Magic Al, titled Good Grief. Now, as our time draws to a very quick close, I'll have to forego two final articles, one about a rap release. Let's see, this is about Nance, who is returning to recording on the latest project called Everyday Dream. And I'll save this in my folder and give it hope that I can get to it at a later issue of Indie Week. And finally, a book by Gabriel Bump, which was released on November 14th, called The New Naturals. And I can't even go into it because time is running out. That goes back into the bin as well, and it's about Gabriel Bump's arrival in North Carolina to come to join the faculty there at UNC. Well, I must leave, and I will not actually be for the next issue of Indie Week, assuming that one is published directly after Christmas holiday, and I hope somebody will read such an issue if it exists. Other than that, I will be back in 2 weeks. The contents of this particular issue are available as a podcast on ncreadingservice.org. John Federson, happy holidays of any sort to anyone who wants one. Bye-bye.